There was a time when families gathered around the warm hum of the radio for thrills and chills. Voices in the dark telling stories that pried open the imagination and let something unspoken slip in. Tonight, we return to that sacred space between static and silence. These are tales of vanishing rooms, impossible photographs, haunted houses, and strange frequencies. So settle in. Let the world outside fade, and let your mind paint the pictures. Because what you're about to hear isn't just entertainment. It's an invitation to explore the boundaries of where fact meets fear. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is the Paranormal 360. Meet Claire Donnelly, practical, grounded, a pragmatic woman of numbers and logic, not flights of fancy. She doesn't believe in fate. She doesn't trust dreams. But tonight, something or someone is about to shake that belief to its core. And when sleep arrives, so too does a warning from a place that lies just beyond the veil of reason, a place like the Paranormal 360. It began as strange things often do, in the quietest part of the night. Claire Donnelly had never been superstitious. She didn't read horoscopes. She didn't believe in fate. She believed in data, deadlines, and sleeping with a white noise machine set to ocean breeze. But on a cold Tuesday night in March, a dream visited her that felt less like the brain cleaning house and more like a transmission. There was a man at the foot of her bed, not a hazy figure fading in and out like most dreams. No, this one had weight, a presence. He was tall, dressed in a dark overcoat, and though his face remained obscured under the low brim of a weather-beaten hat, his posture was rigid, like a soldier frozen in a moment of warning. His voice cut through the air, low, firm, and eerily grounded in her reality. "Don't take the bridge." And then he was gone. He sat upright, drenched in sweat. It was 3:04 a.m. The numbers glared at her like an accusation. He lay there, heart hammering, listening for the sound of a voice that no longer filled the room. But she could still feel the rumble through her ears like distant thunder. The next night, he returned. This time closer, at her bedside. His coat still buttoned high, his gloved hands by his sides. The air around him felt heavier, and Claire, caught between waking and sleep, could smell something sharp. Old, a mix of tobacco, burnt paper, and dust. His mouth began to move. "They won't see it coming." The words rolled through her, not heard, but felt like bass through a floorboard. She woke with a strangled breath, gasping as if surfacing from underwater. Sleep paralysis, she told herself. Nothing more, nothing less. Claire's trip to her sister's house was scheduled for that weekend. A four-hour drive through a patchwork of sleepy towns and farm roads. The fastest way? County Road 63. Right over the narrow old bridge just past Miller's Bluff. She stood in her kitchen Friday morning, coffee gone cold in her hand, staring at her suitcase. Her phone buzzed, a message from her sister. "Can't wait to see you. Drive safe." She dialed instead of texting back. "Hey," Claire said, trying to keep her voice light. "Think I'm going to come next weekend instead. Something came up." Her sister was disappointed, but she didn't press. Claire didn't offer a reason either. 2 days later, Highway 63 made the news. Fog had rolled in heavy. Semi lost control on the bridge, jackknifing across the road. 5 vehicles caught in the chaos, 2 fatalities. An emergency crew struggled to reach the scene. Claire stared at the images on her screen. One of the cars, mangled, burnt beyond recognition, looked just like hers. Same year, same model, even the same color. She didn't move, didn't speak. She didn't breathe for what felt like hours. She also didn't tell anyone, not even Amanda. The man hadn't appeared again, but the feeling lingered. That sense of being observed, of something waiting, just outside of view. Then, one night, she saw him again. Not in a dream, but in the mirror. Claire was brushing her teeth when a flicker caught her eye. He wiped the fog from the glass and saw him, not behind her, but in the reflection, in that gray realm between the mirror's surface. "Don't answer the door," he said. The words stopped her cold. She stared into the glass, willing herself not to look behind. The reflection was empty. The bathroom was still, but the warning echoed. At 2:46 a.m., someone knocked. Three knocks. Slow, measured. She didn't move. She didn't breathe. Then came another three knocks. She waited, unmoving, breath caught in her chest, until dawn. When the sun rose, she found a single muddy footprint on the welcome mat. One bare footprint facing the door. She called the police. They found no sign of forced entry, no one on camera, no disturbance. "Probably just a prank," one officer said. But Claire noticed something else. Her doorbell camera had cut off at 2:44 a.m. and didn't come back on until 3:05 a.m. She didn't sleep the next night either. The day after, a package appeared on her doorstep. There was no postage, no name, no return address. Inside, an antique mirror, heavy, circular, the surface cloudy with age. A piece of masking tape clung to the back with one message in faint typewriter font. "We're not done." That night, he came again. In the mirror. No words allowed this time, only the voice inside her skull, low and tired. "There will be others. I can't protect you from them all." Claire whispered, "Who are you?" He said nothing, but his expression softened. She saw his eyes this time, vast and black, not empty, but burdened. Then, like before, he vanished, like smoke pulled through a crack in reality. Claire moved, got rid of the mirror, took down every reflective surface in her new apartment. She blocked Highway 63 from her phone's GPS, and she kept her doors double locked, her lights on at night, and her dreams closely guarded. But every so often, in those final moments before sleep overtakes her, Claire swears that she can almost hear the voice as it calls out to her, "Don't forget me." And she never will, because she knows now there are things in this world that whisper warnings we don't always want to hear. Some come in dreams, some come through reflections in time, and some come from a place not bound by time at all. A place just beyond reason. A place like the Paranormal 360. Our next tale brings us to a quiet tree-lined street in a mid-century neighborhood, where one couple seeking a fresh start finds a house filled not just with memories, but murmurs. Sounds that travel through old vents like echoes from lives once lived. Lives that never truly left. Tonight, you've turned into a radio signal that may be listening back. But that's to be expected when you tune in to the Paranormal 360. Ava and Thomas Burke weren't looking for perfection, just peace. They had spent 3 years packed into a noisy, overpriced apartment in the city. Paper-thin walls, screaming neighbors, sirens at all hours. They were ready for quiet, for calm, for somewhere they could finally exhale. And that's what the house on Pelham Lane promised. A single-story brick ranch, wide front porch, twin maple trees casting lazy shadows across the yard. built in 1957, just one previous owner. The place even had a fireplace and an old rotary doorbell that gave a satisfying ding when you turned it. Good bones, the realtor said. Original ductwork, too. Oversized return in the hallway, but that's just meaning better circulation. Neither of them thought to ask why a modest ranch house would need such an industrial-sized vent system. They just signed the papers, and they were owners within the week. The first night felt like a dream. They drank wine from plastic cups, sat on the floor, and laughed at how empty the house sounded. The silence was beautiful. No neighbors, no shouting, no alarms, no gunshots, just the occasional creak of old wood settling into the night. They fell asleep in each other's arms, exhausted but grateful. At 2:12 a.m., Ava awoke. Not from a nightmare, not from a sound exactly, but more from a feeling. She sat up in bed and listened. Somewhere in the hallway, someone was talking. Low murmurs at first. There was a rhythm and a cadence. Not shouting, not exactly whispering, but it was a conversation, as if a radio had been left on or people were standing just out of view. She slid out of bed, feet soft on the wood floor. The hallway was dimly lit by the moonlight spilling through a window. And there, on the floor, sat the massive air vent, easily 2 feet across. She crouched beside it. The metal grill was cool beneath her palm. Inside, from deep in the ducts, came the soft sound of humming. A woman's voice. And just beneath that, a reply. A man, calm but muted. She leaned closer, and the voices stopped. The next morning, she told Thomas. He smiled sleepily and unbothered. It's an old house, honey. Ducks can carry sound weird. It could have just been a TV from the next door neighbors. Honey, the nearest house is 100 yards away, she replied. Well, maybe squirrel with just good taste in music, he teased, brushing past her. That afternoon, she set her phone on the floor beside the vent and hit record. She let it run while she unpacked the kitchen. And when she played it back later, her heart stopped. The audio was faint but unmistakable. A man's voice. She hears us. Things changed after that. The whispers grew bolder. She heard names, faint, fading words like wake her. The humming became a lullaby. It always started when she passed the hallway, and it always stopped when she turned to listen. Thomas remained unconvinced. He joked, he blamed the drafts, old wiring, even her imagination. But even he couldn't laugh it off with what happened next. At 3:17 a.m., they woke to the sound of metal hitting the floor. Every vent in the house, hallway, bedroom, kitchen, had come open. The covers lay beside them, screws neatly placed in tiny piles. They had not been ripped off, just removed. And the house was freezing. Thomas searched room to room with a baseball bat in hand. But there was no sign of forced entry. No footprints, no animals, just an eerie silence. They called a technician, and Carl was in his 60s and looked like he'd seen too many basements and not enough daylight. After 2 hours crawling through ducts and checking the furnace, he came back with a tight frown. Your central vent, he said. Massive. Shouldn't be in a place like this. He scratched his head. This layout, it's not standard. I've seen it once before. It was in a house that burned down back in the 1940s. And they reused the ducts. Some of them got built over. Built over? Ava repeated. Carl nodded. Yeah, instead of tearing the whole thing out, they just sealed it, buried it under new construction. He hesitated. You ever hear anything strange? Voices or shifting in the vents? Ava and Thomas said nothing. Carl did not stay for coffee. He could read the room. That night, Ava dreamed of being underground. She crawled through ducts that shrank the farther she went in. Her hands were raw. Her breath came in short, panicked bursts. In the darkness ahead, he heard someone sobbing. Behind her, a voice, low and hollow.
"You don't belong here."
She woke, choking on her own breath. They went to the records office at the Historical Society the next day. The current house they found was built in 1957. But before that, a two-story Victorian owned by the Hollis family burned to the ground in 1949. The cause? A faulty furnace. 5 people inside, but only 2 bodies had been recovered. The other 3? Missing. They were never found. A neighbor's old statement had been preserved in the report, and Ava read it aloud in a whisper.
"Even after the fire, we still heard them, crying through the floor grates, talking, begging. The house was gone. Their voices stayed."
That evening, Ava didn't run. He didn't record. He sat cross-legged in the hallway and stared at the open vent. "Who are you?" she asked. First, there was nothing. Then a voice, a male voice, dry and broken like wind through dead leaves.
"They covered us, buried us in the walls, then forgot."
Ava's voice trembled as she asked what they wanted. This time the voice came out from every vent in the house.
"Get out of our house."
That night, Thomas finally heard them too. They woke to footsteps in the halls, slow, deliberate, too heavy to be rodents, too rhythmic for pipes, and the air around them turned icy. Then, with a loud growl of sorts, the furnace roared to life all by itself. And then as they clutched each other, underneath the covers, the air ducts groaned. A chorus of voices rose from within, moaning, wailing, crying out all at once. And then came the deafening silence. After a few terrifying moments, one final whisper from the hallway.
"He understands now."
They moved out within a week, lost their deposit, broke their contract, but they didn't care. Now they live on the 3rd floor of a building with no vents, no noisy neighbors above, and they sleep with the fans on or music playing, anything to keep that horrific silence away. Some homes carry more than memories. Some carry echoes of the lives that lived within them, lives that may never have left. And if you're ever alone in the quiet and your house begins to whisper, listen. Sometimes they're waiting for you to respond. Don't touch that dial, because we will be back with more. Welcome, Darklings. You're about to meet a man who spent his life listening to voices across oceans, data through static, whispers carried on waves no one else could hear. Tonight, he'll tune into something he was never meant to find, something that doesn't just transmit, it chooses. And when the signal calls, you don't change the channel, it changes you. Because this isn't just a frequency, it's a warning wrapped in a whisper, looping back through time, waiting for someone to hear it. And Marcus Killian, he just made contact. And like the glow of the radio dial before you, you've made contact to your portal to the strange. Welcome back to the Paranormal 360. Marcus Killian had always trusted machines more than people. People were emotional, inconsistent, but frequencies didn't lie. They carried only what was sent, no more, no less. So when he accepted a post-retirement contract job monitoring anomalous atmospheric frequencies in a remote part of Nebraska, he welcomed the isolation. The observatory sat alone atop a low plateau, 3 miles from the nearest road, surrounded by fields that shifted in the wind like a breathing thing. Most nights, it was just Marcus, his equipment, and the sky. It was the perfect job, until the night something out there found him. It began on a Tuesday. The air was dry and brittle, and the wind had dropped to a rare dead calm. Marcus sat alone in the control room, a dim red lamp casting long shadows across the consoles. He was idly scanning high-frequency bands, half listening to the soft rustle of static when the spectrum analyzer pulsed. Then, the voice came through.
Event projection 449 CST, Highway 6, collision, 3 deceased.
Just a sterile male voice, followed by 3 tones. Then silence. He blinked at the readout. The frequency, 18.136 megahertz, wasn't registered for anything. Not commercial, not military, not even listed among rogue pirate bands. Something that shouldn't exist, but it did. He played the recording back twice. There was no origin trace, no bounce, as if the transmission had birthed itself directly inside the receiver. Marcus logged it, copied the file, and wrote it off as some elaborate prank. And then he went to bed. At 6 a.m., the news came in. There was a 3-car pileup on Highway 6. The time of the incident, 4:52 a.m. 3 people dead. He sat there, the report open on his laptop, heart ticking like a Geiger counter. The next night, he waited. No channel surfing, no logging, just him and the frequency. At exactly 3:33 a.m., the signal returned.
Substation overload, grid 14, 1 casualty.
That morning, a lineman was electrocuted while performing repairs near a substation in Lancaster County. Marcus didn't believe in psychic phenomena. He believed in data, precise, timed, patterned, logical data. So he began testing it. He rerouted the receiver through a Faraday cage, isolated it from the antenna, used a portable battery supply instead of building power. He even relocated the equipment to his trailer to eliminate any local interference. And yet, every night at 3:33 a.m., the signal found him. By the end of the week, he had 3 more recordings. Each transmission described an event, a drowning, a house fire, a mechanical failure on a grain elevator. All deadly, all confirmed. Each haunted him more than the one before. He contacted Ellis, a former colleague from his days at Fort Meade, now working with the FCC. Ellis, I've got a rogue frequency issuing death reports before they happen, Marcus said. There was a long pause on the line.
18.136?
Ellis asked finally. Yes.
Listen, I shouldn't be telling you this, but that frequency was part of an experimental Cold War program called Echo Mirror. Predictive analytics, signal AI. They shut that thing back down in 1989.
Why?
Because it didn't just predict disasters. Some people believed it caused them.
That night, the voice changed.
Operator MK detected. Observation commencing.
He recoiled from the screen. He pulled the plug, every cord, every cable, shut the whole system down, even his laptop. Still at 3:33 a.m., the laptop turned on by itself. No boot screen, just black, then a single blinking line of white text.
You've been marked.
The screen flashed once, and then went dark. Marcus fled, driving 3 hours west to a backwards motel with no internet access, no cable, no cell reception. He paid in cash, kept the lights off. The room reeked of mildew and dust, but it was far from that lab. Damn it, that was good enough, or so he thought. At 3:33 a.m., the television flickered on, and words began scrolling across the screen.
Integration begins at dawn.
His breath caught in his throat as another line appeared.
You are the signal now.
He smashed the screen with a violent kick. The tube imploded in a shower of sparks. But he knew it didn't matter. The signal had already taken root. With his head hung in acceptance of his strange fate, he returned to the observatory. Back at the observatory, the speakers crackled to life, welcoming him back with an ominous message.
You are not the first operator, but you will be the last.
Tears streamed down his face as he wept in silent resignation. That night, the signal came early, 3:29 a.m. The shriek that erupted from the lab speakers split the air like a siren from another world. The sound distorted reality, bending the edges of the room. Marcus collapsed, blood trickling from his ears. The next morning, he awoke on the floor, eyes bloodshot, chest tight. His recorder still ran, though he had no memory of turning it on. The audio captured nothing but a constant low pulse and one phrase.
Integration failed.
Desperate, Marcus remembered the training compound outside Cheyenne, an old relay station, buried deep. He'd done signal testing there once 20 years ago. It was dark, forgotten, and shielded. He drove through the night, barely stopping, fueled by gas station coffee and sheer panic. The bunker was intact, locked, but his old credentials were. Inside, rusted consoles, broken monitors, but silence. He set up one receiver, no antenna, just a recorder and a single screen. Midnight passed, then 1 a.m., then 2:45. He sat in stillness for yet another hour. He opened his notebook to document this radio silence, and he froze. The last page was already filled out, not from his hand, but somehow it was his handwriting. Operator 360A present. Synchronization complete. Begin transmission. His fingers trembled and he dropped the pen. And from somewhere, deep in the circuitry of the discarded equipment, a voice spoke out.
Signal integrity confirmed.
He reached for the receiver. It was alive, broadcasting. Then Marcus realized he was no longer the listener. He had become the antenna. Marcus Killian was never seen again. Weeks later, when seismic anomalies registered near the compound, a federal survey team was dispatched. They found the entrance breached. Inside, no signs of struggle, no human remains. Only a single active transmitter, powered by a burned-out battery, feeding signal through a dead repeater, and the monitor pulsed with one phrase.
Operator Killian online. Sequence initiated.
There are signals that come from towers and some that come from memory. And once you're tuned in, you don't get to turn it off. Finally, let me introduce you to a woman who thought she knew every inch of her home. For 20 years, she walked the same halls, lived with the same creaks and groans of the old place, but in this house, the architecture seems to have plans of its own. And when the layout begins to shift, reality may follow. Tonight, she'll learn the space between walls holds more than insulation. It holds secrets, just like the Paranormal 360. Rachel Samuels had lived in the little house on Cypress Lane for 2 decades. It was the kind of neighborhood where time slowed down. Old trees arched over narrow streets, porches leaned just a bit too far forward, and everyone waved like they knew you, even if they didn't. The blue bungalow wasn't perfect. Peeling paint, creaky floors, strange hums from the walls, but it was hers. And after the divorce, the silence felt like a victory, and the house had become her sanctuary. The floor plan was simple. 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, a small kitchen that looked directly into the living room. She'd cleaned every baseboard, painted every wall at least twice, and even replaced the hinges on the hallway closet herself, which is why, on the 9th of April, the new door stopped her heart. She had turned off the TV and was walking to her bedroom when she saw it, nestled there between the bathroom and the guest room. Narrow, with chipped yellow paint and a knob that didn't match the others. It hadn't been there before. She was sure of it. Rachel stared at it so long, her legs began to shake. She stepped closer, fingertips grazing the cool brass knob. It wasn't dusty. No draft came from beneath it. And it fit the hallway trim perfectly, like it had always been part of the house. But she knew it hadn't, right? Was she having a stroke, she wondered? How could she not recognize this door in her home, in a space she had walked thousands of times? Slowly, she reached out a trembling hand, her mind racing, and she grabbed the knob and twisted. The knob creaked, and the door moaned in rebellion as she opened it. Inside was a deep, narrow closet. Wood-paneled walls, no shelves, no bar for hangers, just an empty space, and the faintest smell like flowers pressed between old book pages. She shut the door and backed away slowly. Rachel shuffled to her bedroom door in disbelief. She lay awake for hours as her mind tried to make sense of this impossible thing. When sleep finally did come for her, she dreamed of a hallway that curved back into itself, lined with doors that opened to nowhere. To her utter astonishment, the door was still there the next morning. She searched the hallway for signs of change, discoloration in the paint, scratches on the floor, anything that might explain it, but there was nothing. She texted her sister, "Hey, weird question. Do you remember a second closet in my hallway?" Her sister's texted reply brought no comfort. "No, why?" Rachel didn't answer. 2 days passed before she opened the door again. This time, there was something inside. A single child's shoe. Worn leather, white laces, scuffed toe, resting neatly in the center of the floor. She knelt down, heart pounding, and picked it up. The shoe was cold. It was damp. And inside, a faint initial was stitched in faded thread. The letter C. She didn't know any children. None had visited, and she certainly hadn't put it there. She placed the shoe outside the closet and closed the door. In the morning, the shoe was gone. She tried to ignore it, left the hall light on, even started sleeping on the couch where the door wouldn't be in her line of sight. But the dreams kept returning. This time, the doors in the hallway opened and closed on their own, creaking slowly one by one until only the closet remained. And from inside the darkness, she recoiled as she heard something breathe. By the end of the week, her nerves were frayed. The closet door creaking when she passed it, just ajar, like it was waiting, almost daring her to open it again. One evening, she wedged a chair beneath the knob. But the next morning, the door was wide open, and the chair lay splintered on the floor. Inside, she found something new. A Polaroid photograph. A blurry photo of a young girl standing in Rachel's hallway, barefoot, one sock sagging at the ankle. Her head was turned toward the closet. In the picture, the door was open, and something was peeking out from behind it. Rachel drove to the county records office that afternoon, demanding the house's history. Built in 1929, 5 owners, 2 deaths in the home, both natural causes. But the clerk hesitated. "There was a missing persons case," she said, tapping the screen. "A child in 1974. The case was never solved. The closet was the last place she had been seen playing." Rachel's mouth went dry. "What was her name?" The clerk squinted. "Caroline Mays." Rachel didn't speak, just nodded, turned and walked out. The shoe? The initial. It was just a single letter, C. That night, Rachel stood in front of the closet, flashlight in hand. She took a deep breath, then opened it wide. Her eyes widened. How was this possible? The closet was even deeper now, far deeper than before. She stepped inside, sweeping the beam of light along the walls. A flicker of movement? She spun, catching a glimpse of something pale and small darting out of view. A child's voice whispered behind her.
"I was just playing."
The door slammed shut. She screamed, pounded against it. The flashlight flickered and then went out. Darkness swallowed her whole. When she came to, she was lying back in her own bed. Sunlight pouring through the window. Birds chirping outside. She sat up slowly, her head spinning. The closet door was gone. Just a blank wall now. Seamless. She ran her hands along the surface. No hinges, no frame, no handle, just paint. Had this all been a dream, a nightmare? She opened every other closet in the house, all normal, all accounted for. Even the guest room was just a guest room again. That afternoon, she burned the photo and the shoe, buried the ashes in the backyard, and weeks passed, and the horrific dreams stopped until one night, while brushing her teeth, she heard a soft creak come from down the hall. A door slowly easing open, and the faintest whisper.
"Want to play again?"
Some houses hide secrets in the walls and dare you to uncover them. As the last story fades and the lights flicker back on, you might be asking yourself, did I lock all the doors? Have I secured the windows? What just made that sound from the basement? In hour two, the world twists even further. A roadside diner becomes an uncomfortable trap. A child's toy speaks. And a final phone call comes from a place no line should reach. Catch your breath, cuddle up close, because when the curtain rises again on your theater of the mind, anything can happen, and just might, when the Paranormal 360 returns.